Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
Welcome, everybody, to Blogging Heads. David Frum speaking to Bruce Bartlett. Bruce is about to publish a new book, and we are here to discuss that and other things as well. Let me introduce myself, and then Bruce will introduce himself. I'm David Frum. I'm a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and editor of the website newmajority.com.
I'm Bruce Bartlett. I write a column for Forbes magazine, and I blog at capitalgainsandgames.com.
Bruce, many of us have been treated to sort of advanced glimpses of your book through your fantastic Facebook postings. But for those who are unfamiliar with what you have to say and what you have been arguing over the past couple of years, why don't you take the talking stick and explain?
Okay. The book kind of grew out of an op-ed article that I had in the New York Times a couple of years ago, in which I made the argument that supply-side economics was no longer a useful, separate, distinctive element of economics, that everything that was true and correct about supply-side economics from when it was conceived back in the 1970s had now been fully integrated into mainstream economics. Back in the 1970s, it was common to hear mainstream economists say that tax rates don't really matter and marginal tax rates are of no importance. And there was very little research done on the incentive effects of taxation. Now, I think it's pretty generally understood across the political spectrum that we don't want to go back to the high rates that existed during the 1970s when the top rate went up to 70%, and that it's a good idea to have a lower rate on capital gains and things like that. And all that's really left of supply-side economics is a caricature that all tax cuts raise revenue and all tax increases lose revenue, or some similarly nonsensical idea. And so that was what I wrote this op-ed about. And as I thought about it some more, it seemed to me that supply-side economics had a lot in common with Keynesian economics in this sense. Both supply-side economics and Keynesian economics came into being to deal with real economic problems that the existing consensus view of economics was unable to deal with. The classical economists of the 1920s, 1930s said the economy's automatically regulates itself, and any government intervention will just make matters worse. And this clearly was not a good strategy. And Keynes came along and developed a theory that helped end the Great Depression. And for this, Keynesian economics became the dominant view. The problem was that once we were past the Depression, Keynesian theories became misapplied or inappropriately applied in circumstances where they didn't work and in fact made matters worse. And in particular, Keynesian policies tended to be inflationary. And by the 1970s, the inflation problem was so great, it was a very serious concern. And the Keynesians basically had nothing to offer. So they became discredited. And in that vacuum, the supply-siders came along. And what they argued was basically we needed tight money, which the Keynesians are almost always against, tight money to eliminate inflation, and tax rate reductions to stimulate economic growth. And the Keynesians thought this policy was completely insane. They felt that any policy that increased the deficit was per se inflationary, and that tight money would just absolutely destroy the economy. So it was the exact opposite of what Keynesians would have proposed. But again, the policy was successful. By 1983, the economy was booming. Tax rates were down, and inflation had more or less collapsed. And so the supply-siders got the same benefit that the Keynesians had gotten during World War II for dealing with this very serious problem. But then the same cycle took over, which is that these supply-side policies became, I think, misapplied, and most particularly during the George W. Bush administration. I think that people lost sight of what supply-side economics was all about, and a lot of not very good tax cuts were passed willy-nilly. Tax credits and tax rebates were proposed as supply-side measures, which had nothing whatsoever to do with supply-side economics. And I think that as a consequence, those policies failed, and that brings us to where we are right now.
Robert Skidelsky quips somewhere in his Keynes biography that things would have been a lot better in the post-war world if Keynes had called his great book not the general theory but a special theory, and understood that it was and had made more clear what he himself understood, that this was an in case of emergency break glass approach to economics, not the sort of thing you should be doing every single day.
That's right. But I think Keynes did what he did, or named his book the way he did, precisely because he had been trying. Remember, his book came out in 1936. And we'd been suffering from a depression since 1929 or 30, and he had said a great many of the things that were in the general theory. He'd been saying them for a long time in various other venues, and he wasn't getting traction. People weren't paying attention, and so I think he kind of ratcheted things up with the general theory by making it more than it really was. As you say, it was really a theory for the times. But by making it seem like a general theory, perhaps that was the reason people were willing to pay attention to it.
And that certainly happened to supply side. It became not a policy response to the crisis of the late 70s, but it became a whole alternative way of being and a whole alternative form of knowledge.
That's right. And I think for various reasons, the people who call themselves supply-siders have been deeply alienated from mainstream economics and have gone out of their way to emphasize their differences rather than emphasizing their similarities. And one of the things that I tried to do in the book is sort of thread the needle a little bit by separating what I still think is correct about supply-side economics from some of the nonsensical stuff. So I will, at the same time, I sort of irritate liberals who think that it was all hokum and just hocus pocus and mumbo jumbo that had no redeeming qualities, and will alienate to people today who still think that supply side economics is important to maintain as a separate identity. So I'll probably end up alienating everybody.
Well, I think we share that same genius marketing strategy. So,
how did that work out for you?
Exactly, counts for both of our worldly success. But let me ask you whether there isn't a risk that you are premature here, because one of the foundations of your thinking is that you assert at the beginning of this conversation and throughout your work that the true insights of the neoclassical revolution or the supply-side revolution of the 70s, whatever you want to call it, have been now so thoroughly integrated into the way we think about the world that there's no danger that these truths will be lost sight of. And yet it looks like there may be such danger after all. When you think about how will a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress cope with the debt overhang that's going to be left behind by the measures we're doing now, it seems very likely that we're going to be in a period in which there's going to be a lot of pressure for higher rates of tax on work saving and investment, and the whole point of supply side economics was to tell people not to do that.
Well, that's right. And when we get to the last chapter in the book, I sort of ask the question of, okay, Keynesian economics came and went, supply side economics came and went. What comes next? And I finished the book right in December of last year, right as everything was going to hell. And so my original idea was to deal with the growing debt problem, which kind of got overtaken by all these problems of stimulating the economy and all. But I still think that the point I tried to make, and I have made in many articles and things, is that we need to restructure our tax system in order for it to be able to bear a higher level of taxation. That is, we need to raise the tax GDP ratio up to, I'm not quite sure what, 22-23% of GDP from its historical level of around 18%.
That's the federal take, because the states and federal, localities take another 10 points on top of that.
That's right. And what I've tried to argue is that supply side economics tells us a lot about how to raise revenues in a way that is least damaging to the economy. And so I believe we should have a value-added tax, such as they have in every other industrialized country. But this gets us back to this whole idea of supply-side economics today being a caricature, which is simply anti-tax. Mm-hmm. Is that the supply-siders today, or the people who speak for the supply-siders, are just adamantly opposed to any increase in taxation, no matter what it is, or they believe there is no reason to ever raise taxes for any purpose. They believe in a silly theory called starving the beast, which says that all you have to do is cut taxes and somehow or other spending will magically come down. And so therefore, the supply-siders today pay no attention whatsoever to the spending side of the budget. It's simply irrelevant to their concerns. All they want to do is just keep taxes as low as possible, and somehow or other they believe that that will solve all of our problems. But I think that that is just complete and total nonsense.
Well, is it really complete and total nonsense? One of the in the heroic tribal history of the supply side, as I was taught it when I was working at the Wall Street Journal, one of the great landmarks is the defeat of I believe he was chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Al Ullman. He lost his seat in 1978 or 80. And he had been a big proponent of a value-added tax.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it true that if we began to have these chronic fiscal problems in the late 1970s, had the United States adopted a value-added tax in 1980, which you can well see why people would have wanted to do it, that would have sent us to 22 or 23% of GDP to the federal government back then. And mm-hmm. we would today, confronting the retirement of the baby booms and worsening fiscal problems, now be on our way to having to think about taking the federal share to 26 or 27% with mm-hmm. some new set of, that it did work in the context of 1978-80, that by beating back the value-added tax then, forcing the government more to make do with what resources it had, that we slowed the growth in federal spending over a quarter century period. That's not nothing.
No, I think there was something to the Star of the Beast theory when it was first developed in the 1970s, because we had economic problems of inflation and high interest rates that could plausibly be tied directly to the existence of a large deficit. So there was a lot of political support for the idea of cutting the deficit. And the problem Republicans had been dealing with up until that point was that they acquiesced in higher taxes to deal with the deficit, and Democrats just spent more and created a new deficit. And so Republicans felt, rightly or wrongly, that they were
tax collectors for the welfare
state. Tax collectors for the welfare state, that's right. I was thinking more along the lines of the guy who has to clean up after the elephants in the circus parade, but the same basic idea. And of course, the supply-side idea was to stop playing that game. Let's just cut taxes like they did in California with Proposition 13 and allow the anti-deficit pressure to manifest itself in terms of lower spending. And to a large extent, that worked. The problem is today nobody really cares about the deficit. We have historically low interest rates, historically low inflation. There's no real economic problem facing people that can be tied to the deficit or the debt. And so there really is no significant pressure to reduce deficits, and yet the supply-siders are still talking about starving the beast as if that anti-deficit pressure is still there. So the consequence is that we've ended up with lower taxes and higher spending simultaneously.
Well, let me ask you, in your list of deviations, are you moving away from the idea that a smaller state government sector is a good thing in itself? Because I still believe that you want the government sector to be as small as possible.
Well, I think smaller is better, but at the same time, I think we have lost sight of what it is we're trying to keep governments, why we're trying to keep governments small. For example, as you know, almost every other major country has a significantly higher spending as a share of GDP than we do, and much higher taxes as well. But almost all of that difference is accounted for by one thing, and that is health care. In almost every other country, they have some sort of national health care scheme that ensures everybody, and people pay higher taxes to pay for that health insurance. Whereas here, you know, people pay vast amounts of money out of their pockets and through reduced wages for health insurance.
Right.
And it's done in the private sector.
And it costs more, and it's not as good.
Well, that's right. I think the left has played their cards very badly in the healthcare debate. The biggest single thing about healthcare in this country that I think is important is that we spend almost twice as much as a share of GDP on health as everybody else. And I think this is pretty remarkable. About half of all the money we spend on health in this country is paid for by government. So that's about 8%, 8-9% of GDP. Almost every other country in the world has a complete and total national health insurance scheme for about the same percentage of GDP.
Between 10 and 11 is the usual.
Yeah, so we can have
Britain,
a healthcare system.
Britain is less, but there's really.
Yeah, they're about 8%. But I mean, we can have a healthcare system no worse than the one they have in France, which is considered to be pretty good, or Britain, or any number of other countries, and cut the amount of money that's coming out of people's pockets to pay for healthcare by 5% of GDP. That's a lot. You know, I think Obama got off on the wrong track.
Well, that was exactly the case he made. I mean,
I know he made that case. Yes.
Advocates of greater role of government in healthcare have for years been making the case based on free money for you, which amazingly they've managed to lose. So Obama tried a different approach, which is you will eat your nice gruel and you will like it. And that has also turned out not to work. This thing has been focused entirely. He's presented it very much as a budgetary proposition. Here's a great way to save money. And that makes people suspicious. And that's lent a lot of credence to the idea that they intend to turn your grandmother into Soylent Green.
Well, yeah, the message has gotten muddled. During the campaign, Obama talked, whenever the issue of the long-term budgetary problem came up, he always said that the budget problem is essentially a health problem, but what he really meant is it's a Medicare problem, but he didn't say that, which is what he should have said. But then once he got into office, instead of putting forward a health care initiative that would constrain long-term costs, which is something I think he could have gotten bipartisan support for, he instead got the liberals in the Democratic Party said, well, what's in it for us? And they basically want universal coverage. And so he kind of tried to split the difference and come up with a plan that, on paper perhaps reduces some costs but expands coverage. And this may well pass. I'm not quite sure what the politics of it are as of today. They seem to have improved lately. But it's not going to deal with the basic problem, which is we can't afford the promises we've made for Medicare. And also, I've also repeatedly made the point about Obama's plan is that it's improperly financed. I think it's a very bad idea as a matter of principle to create a broad-based new governmental benefit that is not primarily paid for by the beneficiaries. I think the great strength of Social Security and Medicare up until now is precisely that people pay for the benefits that they receive, or at least to a large extent. We pay the Medicare tax. Medicare Part B is financed partly by premiums. And Obama's breaking that idea. He's going to finance this by Medicare cuts, of which I've never been entirely clear what they are, and a surtax on the wealthy, who will receive no benefits whatsoever from this plan. So I think it was badly misconstrued, and I've believed, to get back to what we were talking about before, he would have been much better off proposing a value-added tax or an increase in the payroll tax to pay for this program so that there would be a linkage between the benefits received and the taxes paid. And if people took the attitude that, hey, I'm not going to pay higher taxes for this benefit, that would tell us something very important about whether this benefit was something we really should be doing.
Right. Well, it may come to that because his plan for financing it so obviously doesn't make sense and isn't going to work that they're going to have to come up with something else because you're not going to pay for anything like what Obama's talking about doing with surtaxes and budget cuts. That's ridiculous.
Well, unfortunately, we operate in 10-year budget windows, and the CBO has said the numbers add up over the first 10 years.
The numbers as you provide them. The numbers as you've provided them to us. I mean, CBO then doesn't independently audit. How much will this health reform really cost?
Right. Well, what CBO has said publicly is that the growth rate of the spending part of the program is greater than the growth rate of the savings and taxes used to pay for it past the 10-year window. I think the figures are something like the benefits grow at about an 8% annual rate and the cost savings to pay for it grow at about a 5% rate. So you clearly have a hemorrhage of spending in the second 10 years. It would be better to have some sort of financing that is symmetrical to the spending so that they rise at the same rate.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about something you said earlier. You said nobody cares about deficits.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking there's a column by, I'm now going to forget who read it, Fareed Zakaria or Jonathan Rauch, I think, about how the real lesson of the past couple of years is that the American political system is actually better than we thought at dealing with crises. It did respond to the financial crisis, maybe not in the most perfect way, but it did respond swiftly and decisively. And it responded swiftly and decisively to the looming failure in Iraq. What the system is not good at is dealing with not crises, but with chronic problems.
Mm-hmm.
And what this implies, it seems to me, is that the way we solve chronic problems is we wait for them to turn into crises and we deal with them then. Now, isn't that going to be true of the deficit? I know people have been predicting this net for years and decades, that one of these days there's going to be, the United States is going to reach the limits of its borrowing capacity. But the mere fact that it hasn't been true till now doesn't rule out that it must be true soon. There has to be some limit to the borrowing capacity in the United States. We're certainly making a serious effort right now to explore what that limit is. And then suddenly, just as the housing bubble wasn't interesting until it became interesting, so the deficit problem isn't interesting until it becomes interesting.
Well, that's right. I've long believed that we will never take meaningful action against the deficit until it is connected to something in people's that directly affects them in their lives, that which is to say, basically inflation and high interest rates, as
a funding crisis of the debt. I mean, it may not be. I don't think you want to go too far out on the limb in predicting that inflation will be the consequence. I mean, it could actually be something much sharper than inflation. That one day there's a dollar crisis.
Well, that's in essence an inflation problem as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, sure, crashing dollar, something like that. And I think there are a lot of conservatives who know perfectly well that the position that they maintain right now is irresponsible, but they believe that only during the political cover of a political or an economic crisis of the sort we're hypothesizing, that's the only time you can really make politically difficult spending cuts. Now, the argument I have made is that this is extremely naive and shows no knowledge about the true nature of the budget, because when you reach a crisis situation, and I worked on a lot of budget deals during the 1980s, is that when you're forced to make near-term budget cuts, when you need to cut spending in this year's budget and next year's budget, you can never cut Social Security or Medicare because you need to phase those kinds of cuts in over a long period of time. They're politically impossible to cut Social Security benefits in the short run. The most you can do is things like raise the retirement age, you know, beginning 10 years from now or something like that. And so those kinds of budget deals are never under consideration when you're facing the crisis. So what it turns out to be in every single case is that the quickest and fastest and most certain way of reducing the deficit in the short run is to raise taxes. Every single budget deal of the 1980s and 1990s contained a very large tax component. And what I've been trying to get people to understand by talking about the value-added tax is if they do these things in a short-term kind of frame of mind, they're going to go after soaking the rich and ratchet up rates to the point where you really do have a serious supply-side problem. Whereas if they would put into place a low-rate consumption tax, it would be a very easy to raise that.
What do you think of a carbon tax? I mean, one of my pet mantras has been, you don't have to believe that global warming is a problem to believe that carbon tax could be the solution.
I think this is another area where Obama made a terrible mistake by going with cap and trade. Economist I know of who has thought about this agrees that a carbon tax makes a lot more sense. And a very broadly based carbon tax comes very close to being a value-added tax, and that's what I've always kind of hoped the left would latch on to.
You overlook, there's a great movie about American politics called, I think, The Great McGinty, Preston Sturges' movie, and it's about this charismatic young Irish barkeeper who rises. He's elected alderman and a mayor and then ultimately governor. And as governor, one of the first things he's confronted with is an appropriation for a repair to the local dam. And he looks, it's very expensive. He looks at it, well, we just repaired this dam 2 years ago. Surely, you know, the dam can't need more repairs now. And the boss tells him, the political boss, the problem with you, McGinty, is you think a dam is something to hold water back. The truth is a dam is something to pour concrete on. And the great news is every 2 years it needs another dose of concrete. Well, the problem with what you think is the great thing about the value about the carbon tax, which is it's neutral, it's broad-based, raises money, and there's not a lot of opportunity to play games with it, is exactly what's wrong with it. That's the appeal of cap and trade, and as you watch it go through committee, that is the ability to give away the allocations for free. That's the appeal, because those things are currency. As you watch this, that they are peeling off billions, tens of billions, maybe ultimately hundreds of billions of dollars, and giving them away to favored constituencies. And, of course, the way it works is, since not all utilities are equally constituted, these allocations have differential values to different utilities that can then be used to reward shareholders and ratepayers in those states. And it's been really quite a remarkable rent-seeking process. I don't know if you have enough indignation left in you after all these years of watching Congress to find it disgusting, but it's certainly being done on a very grand scale.
No, every person I know who's written, you know, extensively on the subject warned ahead of time not to go down the cap and trade route, because that result was absolutely inevitable. And again, I have to get back to say that it's the president's responsibility to keep the focus on the right policy. And I think what we see here with Obama's strategy in terms of both health care and cap and trade, and probably other things too, is let's just get something out of the Congress, right, and we'll try to fix it later.
He may be just too weak a president.
That's certainly looking more and more to be the case. There doesn't seem to be anything that he wants to accomplish that he's willing to really put a political capital on the line for. He puts forward the most politically palatable version of something that he promised he would do or is under pressure to do, but then he seems to be very happy to stand back and let the congressional meat grinder make a mockery out of the whole process. But at the end of the day, hey, we've achieved victory. You know what it's like in the White House.
Well, the analogy, Henry George wrote this great book about trade 150 years ago, and he was a fabulous writer, And one of his analogies to introduce the possibility of something like cap and trade in Congress, or anything that makes possible the giving away of faith. And he thought about tariffs, but there are other things too. He said it was like throwing a single banana into a cage of monkeys. They'd all be screeching and stamping and demanding their own banana. That's what happened with cap and trades. They are right. I mean, they've decided that. When you look at the bill, and you come to the all important section about the allocations, it's all blank. Mm-hmm. With big white spaces on the page, you know, details TK. And Nancy Pelosi has suggested that maybe 20% of the allocations would be auctioned off for revenue. No answer about what happens to the other 80%. And mm-hmm. if they're given away, the thing that people need to understand is these things are cash. They can be resold. Mm-hmm. If I'm running a utility and I get an allocation, I can close my utility tomorrow and then resell this thing. You've given me, in effect, if not cash, a tradable security. And those are going to hundreds of billions of dollars worth of them. They're going to be distributed across the landscape. And both utilities, and also, of course, because it's a Democratic Congress, to all kinds of consumer associations and trade groups. I think at this point they probably can't give any of them to Acorn, but they might.
Perhaps. But, it's very frustrating. My hope is that maybe we'll get a different dynamic if the Republicans get control of the House next year. Because I think they have been somewhat irresponsible in just saying no to everything rather than coming up with alternatives. And this gets back to some of my complaints about the previous administration. I think, for example, the Medicare drug debate could have been a golden opportunity to put forward a Republican alternative for expanding health coverage. And instead, it was just a giveaway to the elderly to buy re-election. And now Republicans are left without a health plan, and they're doing so well just saying terrible things about Obama's that they haven't been under any pressure to come up with anything of their own. But if they get control of the House of Representatives next year, which seems possible, then the option of just saying no to everything will no longer be an option. They'll have to take responsibility for some of the things that happen.
And for Obama deferring to Congress will then no longer be an option.
That's right. And there's at least the possibility of us getting back to the good old days of the Clinton administration after 94, when both sides were at loggerheads and a lot of problems took care of themselves simply because the government stopped screwing them up.
But you are now past that star of the beast moment. You want government to do affirmative things.
I think it's inevitable that it's not so much that I want government to do affirmative things as I just have given up any hope of controlling entitlements. I think we had an opportunity to do so in the 1980s. I think Ronald Reagan made a mistake by allowing the 1983 crisis to pass with basically just raising revenues instead of restructuring the system. I think George W. Bush's strategy on Social Security wasn't done very well. I think he should have come out with his Social Security plan right after the Social Security Commission report in 2001, instead of waiting a couple of years and then trying to jumpstart it again, and et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, the point is that we're now facing the situation where the baby boomers are all retiring. And the first ones are old enough to qualify for early retirement, 62, and the first one will be drawing Medicare 2 years from now. And so the window of opportunity when we had surpluses and relatively benign demographics is now past. It's just we can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, and we have to deal with the consequences of the fact that entitlement spending is going to grow vastly over the next generation, and we have not put into place any kind of system for financing it.
Well, let me put to you a more searching question, because your book is about economics, but so far we've been talking about budgets. We've been talking about the federal government's economic situation, not the nation's economic situation. In your rethinking of a lot of your insights from the 70s and 80s, do you find yourself raising questions about any of the economic teachings in the broader sense? Does this housing crisis make you rethink? Mm-hmm. Do do you buy into at all any of the complaints about under-regulation? And let me put to you a bugaboo of mine. One of the things that the supply side has shared was a tremendous optimism about, maybe that's not even the right word, but people were production units to them, one person much like another. And so therefore they were very enthusiastic always about immigration. Certainly the Wall Street Journal editorial page where I worked and published so often was so. We're now looking at a situation where the next American labor force looks likely to be a lot less skilled than the American labor force of the past, at the same time as we have a regulatory structure that obviously failed. What conclusions do you draw from that?
Well, I think it's somewhat analogous to the debate we're having about taxation, which is that there was a time when taxes needed to be cut very badly, and I think that the lesson that the supply side has learned is that all taxes are equally bad, and that's not correct. I think some taxes are worse than others, and we need to, unless we're going to abolish taxation, we need to raise it in the ways that produce the least amount of economic distortion. And I think similarly in the area of regulation, there was a time, especially in the 70s, when we really did severely over-regulate, and I think we've had a much better regulatory system in many ways since then. And many of the best people in the regulatory area are, in fact, Democrats. They understand that there are certain types of regulations, such as we used to have with the airlines, that we don't want to go back to. But I think too many on the right just view all regulation as bad, and the less regulation, the better. But I think it's quite clear from the way some of the regulatory agencies behaved during the run-up to the recent crisis. I mean, I don't see how you can possibly defend the Securities and Exchange Commission's actions over the last few years. They clearly fell down on the job and didn't do the job that they existed to do. And the same is true for other agencies that oversaw the housing area and so on. And somehow or other, we need to get back to the idea that we don't necessarily want more regulation or less regulation. What we want is good regulation. We need, so unless you're just ideologically opposed to any regulation, which of course some libertarian types are, then the sensible thing is how do we reform regulation to make it do its job at the least burden to the economy, and similarly with taxes, how do we reform taxes so that we raise the revenue that we have to pay for government in the least damaging way possible and get away from this very sterile tax increase versus tax cut debate, which has dominated discussion.
You're still focusing here on government management rather than the fundamental behaviors of economies.
I'm not sure where you're going.
Well, you know, we've had a lot of Nobel Prizes given. For argument about the way stock markets work and financial markets. Paul Krugman, among others, have said that this crisis calls into question whether or not that kind of approach to the operation of markets, and especially financial markets, was true. Was it right? At the same time, we confront a situation where we have, among people 16 to 24, an unemployment rate over 50%, which is really shocking. Really shocking. And the human costs of it are quite horrifying. But when you look at that population, what you also see is that is a population that is much less skilled than the equivalent population was 30 years ago. And it's kind of hard to think how are we going to get that 16 to 24-year-old population. And remember, the job seekers exclude mm-hmm. those who are enrolled in school. So that's the lower two-thirds of the 16 to 24-year-old cohort. We have a population on our hands that is going to be more difficult to put into fully productive work than was true of the 16 to 24-year-olds of the 1980s.
Well, I think that's going to be true. And you're sort of looking at it from a micro point of view. I think the macro point of view, unfortunately, reinforces that. I think we're looking very much at a jobless expansion, a jobless recovery. I think the returns to skill, to education, are going to become even greater, and that we're going to have a crisis down the road of inequality of a have-not and have nation, which really kind of in a way gets me back to my basic theme is that we're traveling down the route of Europe. and many Americans just hate that idea. It's, you know, if you're in any group of conservatives and you say, oh, that's will take us down the route of Europe, they'll all say, oh, no, we don't want to do that, that's awful. Nobody ever explains what's so terrible about Europe.
Let me throw it at you, because this is not just a problem for conservatives. The Europeans run the kinds of societies they do because they're societies with very high levels of cohesion. And as I watch, for example, the debate over the Obama health plan, and the rage you saw at a lot of those town halls, and granted, it was the TV cameras go looking for rage. And, as E.J. Dionne points out, there are many, many of these things that were just as boring as could be, and nobody paid any attention to that. But yet there was again and again this theme of we're losing our country, something's changing. Mm-hmm. Those people who said those things were reflecting, I think, a reality. They wouldn't know the numbers here, but of the existing Medicare population is what? About 85% white, and another 10-12% African American, 5% everybody else. The population of the uninsured is 1 in 4, 4 in mm-hmm. 4. Some of those people are, you know, not legal, illegal is the distinction, mm-hmm. but and many of them have become naturalized, but 1 in 4 of the uninsured are 1 in 4. So what Obama is proposing is a plan to squeeze Medicare benefits that go to the native-born population and the older native-born population, and to use those savings to confer a benefit on people who are foreign-born. Understandably, the native-born resent that. And mm-hmm. if you are going to have continuing huge intake of foreign-born people, continuing huge intake of, unlike Canada and Australia, very low-skilled foreign-born people who are not going to earn wages that are sufficient to pay for their own health care, you're going to finance all of this by extending government guarantees. You're going to cover them by extending government guarantees financed in various redistributive ways. That's the crisis. That's why Europe is ceasing to be Europe. As Europe mm-hmm. has become more diverse, that the tolerance of the society for redistribution diminishes. I mean, Sven Svensson may be willing to pay a fairly high rate of tax to provide benefits to Sven Svensson, you know, senior, but is he willing to pay such benefits for services to people who are in no way related to him, don't speak his language, don't share his values, and I mean, may regard as subversive or dangerous?
I think that's right. The European welfare state did develop the way it did because they had, to a much greater extent than we have, homogeneous societies. And as you say, in places like Sweden, practically everybody's related to each other anyway. But the thing is that they've got the same problems now with the huge influx of Turks and
right.
other.
Sweden has almost a 10% foreign-born population. And this
they've been. Yeah, they don't have the problem of illegal immigration like we have, but they have they pretty much admit anybody who says they're oppressed or something. And but the problems are still there. And I think, you know, to sound like a broken record, if you're going to have a policy of extending some governmental benefit that cannot realistically be segregated away from to go only to the native-born population, you need to have a financing mechanism that everybody contributes to. If you had a value-added tax, every time some illegal immigrant went into the Safeway to buy tortillas, he'll be paying that tax. And so we need to get away from the kinds of taxes that are easy to evade and get more towards taxes that everybody has to pay. And I would point out also that we've got another crisis in the fact that 47% of tax filers, federal income tax filers, have zero or negative tax liability. This is just not feasible going forward. We need to have broader-based taxation, but this is an area where the left and the right completely agree with each other. There's no way we're going to introduce a tax that makes people paying nothing, you know, have to have a tax liability, because the percent change in their liability is infinite. They're going from zero to anything.
As we wind down here, offer a thought that is much on my mind. Now, when you talk to your typical conservative about American history, they believe that what we've seen is a struggle between liberalism and conservatism going back to the early days of the Republic, and that basically the the dividing line between, you know, Jefferson and Hamilton, why that's just like our politics today. Of course, that's, mm-hmm. that's completely wrong. What we have is a series of crises that generate new party systems, new that come into focus over they come into focus over whatever the issues in contention at the time were. That the liberal dividing line between liberal and conservative, you can date that as beginning in the 1930s or the 1950s or becoming really powerful in the 1970s, is an argument over the welfare state. Mm-hmm. So just a moment. Yes, I'm on the telephone. I'm on the telephone. Yes. Oh, hi there. Okay. Sorry, I'm staying in a hotel.
The welfare state.
my daughter just walked into the frame. Well, there wasn't the housekeeper coming. But if we look back 100 years ago, we see that the thing that preoccupied Americans in the 1890s and 1900s was the issue of corruption and incompetence in local government. And then you had a divide between capital P progressives and others over that issue. Is it possible that as we transition to this whole new set of problems, that our existing ideological, the parties are here for keeps, that you just put new meaning to them, mm-hmm. but the existing ideological structure becomes so obsolete that we have to stop using words like conservative and liberal, left and right, in just the way that it would have been silly to talk about progressives and stalwarts if you were debating politics in the 1970s.
Well, as you know, the word conservative has quite a different meaning on the continent than it does here, where our sense of the word conservative is more like what Europeans call liberal. So, but I think that given the demographic and economic and other changes we've seen and are definitely going to be seeing more of going forward, I really do think that the conservative elite, at least, need to adopt, frankly, a more of a European notion about what exactly are we here for. Are we anti-everything and sort of quasi-libertarians, or is it our job to try to manage the state so that it doesn't collapse, so that it functions, so that it does what it's there to do, and which is more of a sort of an Eisenhower-ish vision of conservatism that I think most conservatives find repulsive. But yet I think the vision that they have of slashing the state and cutting back massive programs for which there is no votes. And keep in mind that the elderly portion of the population is going to be growing steadily over the next few years. The percentage is going to be getting bigger. And that the elderly vote in the highest percentages of any age group, there's just simply, no matter how much I would like to have a Cato Institute view of the world, I just see that as being utterly utopian, totally pie in the sky, and that at some point we need to get back to a notion that one of the conservative virtues is managing government properly. And I think we've already talked about some of the ways in which Obama is not managing things very well, and I think there's a case for a technocrat type, a person who could have been Mitt Romney, but he decided he didn't want to be what he really was, and he tried to pander to the conservative element and ended up being something inauthentic that was unsuccessful. But I don't know where that person will come from.
Yeah. Well, the thing to bear in mind about Eisenhower was that he was president at a time of remarkable social cohesion and social performance, really, at a time when the society craved security after the traumas of the Depression and the war, and where people had the experience of being in uniform, being rationed, doing what they were told. That was really eat your peas generation. I'm not sure you can govern the United States that way anymore.
Well, surely there'll have to be some sort of long-term consequences to the events of the last couple of years. I don't know what they would be, but it's hard to say. But for the short run, it does seem as if the conservative, just say no to everything attitude is at least politically popular and will be at least through the next election. But I just don't see how the Republicans can ever get the White House back as a whites-only party. And so I think that whatever gains the Republicans make next year will be very pyrrhic.
Republicans can't do that. But that Obama, that's the Republican problem. The Democratic problem is Obama won by fusing, by taking the old Clinton coalition of managers, educated people, not the super haves, but the regular haves, and then merging them with the new coalition he created of very excited, both poor people hard hit by the crisis and minorities who saw him transforming the figure. I think his fiscal policy is undermining that coalition, that he is taxing a lot of the people who made him president in order to provide things to some of the other people who made him president, and you can't keep them both indefinitely happy. So my core political idea is that we have been living through a pretty stable party system from the late 1970s until now, and that we have been refighting the 1972 election over and over and over again, with the Republicans winning all of the early rounds and the Democrats winning some of the later rounds. But all of these coalitions are becoming obsolete. Problems aren't the same problems. It's going to be... We're about to have a cultural and demographic turn.
But it still could be quite a few years off before it really forces change. One of the things that it's interesting you mentioned 72, because I've also been looking at 2012 as another 72 election in this sense, that we're bound to have some bounce back from the recession, and by 2012 the economy could be booming. Both OMB and CBO are predicting 4% real growth in 2011 and 2012. That could be more than enough to win Obama a Nixon-like re-election against a Republican Party that may be deeply fractured between the Palin Huckabee wing and whatever the Gingrich Romney wing or whatever. I don't really know what the political dynamics of that are going to be, but one can easily imagine a very, very bitter Republican party in 2012 that gives Obama a free pass. So that will make things very even more confusing, because they may well keep Congress in the process. So the political class will be trying desperately to see which way the wind is blowing and discover it's blowing every which way simultaneously.
Well, on that cheery note, let me wish you great success with the new book. Encourage all Blogging Heads viewers to go out and lay hands on it. I think there should be a handsome link to it on the right-hand column. We've had a link to it over a couple of days on the New Majority site, and we all look forward to continuing this debate with Bruce Bartlett, who I think all would agree is truly one of the independent minds writing about politics and economy today.
Thank you, David.
Bye-bye.